Good morning. Welcome to the Sunday, November 29, 2015 edition of Waking Up, Freeing Ourselves from Work. Our themes today are three. We need certainty to create a process for developing our vision of a global alternative based in non-coercion and the self-development of our gifts. And continuous harassment bills, taxes, poisoned environment, constant surveillance, and secret weapons used against us. For if you worry an animal continuously, how can it challenge you? Continuous harassment is the basic MO of power at whatever point we intersect with it. And that when you vest a vision on the children, it gets advanced. Whether that vision is born of hate or love, they will try to get it done. Let's support the love. It is urgent. Sisters and brothers, numerous ancestors have noted the evolutionary trajectory of class-bound, class-mutilated humans. We could say it is towards freedom. But even more essentially, it is towards reunion. We want to be together. We are the living analog of that robot in the story, The Iron Giant, that cannot help but reconstitute his original self. That is us, ever striving toward our original wholeness, ever striving to restore our original wholeness. Our species existence presses upon us. This is why we can be certain we'll get there if the power lustful do not destroy all humanity first, for they are stuck in a death spiral and cannot help but pull all of us into it with them if we let them, which we won't. To get to our freedom reunion, we must know what we want, see what stands against it, for our getting it is not inevitable, and be determined to get there. I believe this last comes from Aidos, the balance, our earth-given gift of fairness. Let's listen for a moment to Peter Kropotkin. Peter Kropotkin's observations of the event called the Paris Commune. His insights speak directly to this question of developing certainty that we're considering today. Quote, "This is what Paris did after the 18th of March, 1871. I will never forget," said a friend to us, "those delightful moments of deliverance. I came down from my upper chamber in the Latin Quarter to join that immense open-air club which filled the boulevards from one end of Paris to the other. Everyone talked about public affairs. All mere personal preoccupations were forgotten. No more was thought of buying or selling. All felt ready, body and soul, to advance towards the future. Men of the middle class, even, carried away by the general enthusiasm, saw with joy a new world opened up. If it's necessary to make a social revolution, they said, make it then. Put all things in common. We're ready for it. All the elements of the revolution were there. It was only necessary to set them to work. When I returned to my lodging at night, I said to myself, how fine is humanity after all? But no one knew it. It's always been calumniated. Then came the elections. The members of the commune were named. And then, little by little, the ardor of devotion and the desire for action were extinguished. Everyone returned to his usual task, saying to himself, now we have an honest government, let it act for us. What followed, everyone knows. Instead of acting for themselves, says Kropotkin, instead of marching forward, instead of advancing in the direction of a new order of things, the people, confiding in their governors, entrusted to them the charge of taking the initiative. This was the first consequence of the inevitable result of elections. Let us see now what these governors did who were invested with the confidence of all. Never were elections more free than those of March 1871. The opponents of the commune admitted themselves. Never was the great mass of electors more influenced with a desire to place in power the best men, men of the future, true revolutionists. And so they did. All well-known revolutionists were elected by immense majorities, Jacobins, Blanquists, Internationalists. All three revolutionary divisions were represented in the Council of the Commune. No election could give a better government. But what was the result of it? Shut up in the city hall, charged to proceed after the forms established by preceding governments, these ardent revolutionists, these reformers, found themselves smitten with incapacity and sterility. With all their goodwill and their courage, they didn't even know how to organize the defense of Paris. Of course, people now blame the men, the individuals, for this. But it was not the men who were the cause of the failure. It was the system. In fact, universal suffrage, when it is quite free, can only produce, at best, an assembly which represents the average of the opinions which at the time are held by the mass of the people. And this average, at the outbreak of the revolution, has only a vague idea of the work to be accomplished, without understanding at all how they ought to undertake it. Ah, if the bulk of the nation, of the commune, could only understand before the movement what is necessary to be done as soon as the government is overturned. If this dream of the utopians of the chair could be realized, we never would have had bloody revolutions. The will of the bulk of the nation, once expressed, the rest would submit to it with a good grace. But this is not how things are done. The revolution bursts out long before a general understanding has come. And those who have a clear idea of what should be done the next day are only a very small minority. The great mass of the people have as yet only a general idea of the end which they wish realized, without knowing much how to advance toward that end, and without having much confidence in the direction to follow. The practical solution will not be found, will not be made clear, until the change will have already begun. It will be the product of the revolution itself, of the people in action, or else it will be nothing. The brain of a few individuals being absolutely incapable of finding solutions which can only spring from the life of the people. This is the situation which is reflected in the body elected by universal suffrage, even if it had not the vices inherent in representative governments in general. The few men who represent the revolutionary idea of the epoch find themselves swamped among the representatives of the revolutionary schools of the past and the existing order of things. These men who would be so necessary among the people, particularly in the days of revolution, to so broadcast their ideas, to put the mass in movement, to demolish the institutions of the past, find themselves shut up in a hall, vainly discussing how to wrest concessions from the moderates and how to convert their enemies, while there is really only one way of inducing them to accept the new idea, namely, to put it into execution. The government becomes a parliament with all the vices of a middle-class parliament. Far from being a revolutionary government, it becomes the greatest obstacle to the revolution, and at last the people find themselves compelled to put it out of the way, to dismiss those that but yesterday they acclaimed as their chosen. Unquote, from Peter Kropotkin's Revolutionary Government. Did he not just totally nail down and stand in bright sunlight what happens in every revolutionary situation, i.e., in every moment when energy to turn class is rather fed into the project of reinventing it, into turning it back into itself? If just those few paragraphs had been read and discussed by every revolutionist, would they not have to become an evolutionist? One committed to see us realize our love as a global humanity. Go among the people, says he. Sow our freedom seeds. Sit and have all the taboo discussions we need, the ones that lead to our freedom. And would not this be that process of global visioning that we need?